This edition of The Stack was first broadcast on the 21st of September 2013 on Monocle 24.
Take one literary city, a population hungry for periodicals, and two magazine men with a view or two about the print scene in Australia, and you've got edition 56 of The Stack. This week's special Australia edition of The Stack will see us discuss the state of the industry in this quietly influential hub of print titles, from Aussie conglomerates that went global to a flurry of independent publications that keep on coming. We'll assess the landscape. We'll also look at a men's magazine that takes a rather careful, considered look at the world.
Our philosophy was really to pick up those stories that I think get lost between the cracks between online and maybe mainstream printed press, and give them the attention and time that they deserve.
All that and much, much more today from Melbourne on the special edition of The Stack. Hello and welcome to this very special edition of The Stack, coming to you today from Federation Square here in the heart of Melbourne. I'm Tyler Brûlé. Today we're lucky to be joined by two men who certainly know their way around a newsagent or two in this country. We'll also be talking about, of course, many other things happening in the media sector as well. Our first guest is Jonathan Van Tighelen, editor of Australia's Printed Word title, which of course is devoted to politics, culture, and analysis, and much, much more. Just before we went on air, he of course gave us a peek of his new cover, which is a very, very handsome looking chromoly. The magazine, rather like its compatriots, tends not to mince words. Its current cover story, that would be the one that's on newsstand, Why We Hate Refugees, but it is nonetheless a respected voice of reason in an ever-inflammatory print environment. Jonathan, you were an early voice on The Stack, and it's great to be with you in Melbourne. Thanks for coming.
Hello, Tyler. Thanks for getting me back on.
Now, so for those people who don't see the monthly, and you can find it on the odd newsstand. I've seen it on two or three newsstands, you know, in London. But of course, if you're in this part of the world, pretty easy to find, and of course, dropping through letterboxes as well. What position do you occupy, though, in the Australian news space?
Well, an increasingly lonely one, really, as everything drops around us. I'm not sure if it was happening last time I spoke to you, but we've lost a lot of our, what would have been our competitors, in terms of Current Affairs magazine. We lost the News Weekly, the Bulletin, of course, went some time ago. There's quite a few have gone, so we're basically it.
But why is that? And I want to open this up a little bit more, but you know, if you look at the latest round of ABC figures in the UK, for example, you know, business news and current affairs titles have been done pretty well. If some are growing, some are flat, and, you know, of course, a couple are down as well, but it's actually a reasonably bulletproof sector of the newsstand. So, you know, the territory that you occupy, is it because people are going to The Spectator and they're going to, you know, The Economist and picking up other things, but you know, yet here you have, you know, an incredibly important economy, and you would think that it needs its own reporting on a weekly basis or through a monthly.
It does. There are competitors in a way. I mean, The Spectator here is not The Spectator it is in London, so it has some Australian content, but it's quite tokenistic in many respects. And we wouldn't like to see ourselves branded as a left-wing version of the right-wing Spectator. That wouldn't do us any good at all. Typically, we have been that. That is our image. But we've certainly since I've been editor, I've been very conscious of not just wanting to be a left-wing magazine. I just don't see the point of that. But there is that. That's my personal philosophy. But there's also an opportunity to move slightly more towards the centre, I guess, because there's no one there.
Well, we'll be talking about the prospects for the news and current affairs segment, of course, across the next 55 or so minutes of the program. I'm also joined by Nicholas Carey. Nicholas sent me many, many emails over the last few weeks because he'd sent us a little package. And finally, just before I got on the plane, we don't want to give it away just yet, but your new title arrived. In terms of background, you co-founded the award-winning publication Process Journal, and of course, many people will be familiar, and as I'm sure, you know, when you've tuned in before as well, many of our guests that we've had around our table in London are huge fans of that. Your work has also received a number of AGDA awards, that's the Australian Graphic Design Association, and also recently turns its attention to Booze, well, a periodical, in periodical form anyway. Alchemy is the name of the new title, and Nicholas, Kerry is the co-founder of the title. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So we'll talk about the new title in a second. But what happens with Process Journal?
It is continuing. So I co-founded that with another designer, Thomas Williams, and we did 8 editions of that as a quarterly publication. It had no advertising, and
Was that deliberate that it had no advertising? That was part of the business model.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So that was our first foray into independent publishing, and we wanted, this is our labor of love, little baby. So to put ads amongst these brilliant jobs that we were, projects that we were featuring, it didn't seem right.
Right.
So it had a high cover price of $25, and it didn't make us a fortune. We're not retiring after it, that's for sure. But it gave us a world of experience into independent publishing.
So tell us about this very beautiful new title and occupying, a very interesting space in the market. Of course, our listeners will know that there's always a lot of food and drink coverage when people bring on their particular stack that they want to talk about. So what's the gap that you've found in a very crowded market, particularly on... in this more sort of self-published, smaller space, and also, a country too, which, does a very good job of course, doing more mainstream magazines devoted to food, drink, and lifestyle.
Well, after I stepped aside from Process, I had a bit of a moment where I just wanted to build my own studio, and I wanted to, I think I swore never to, touch another magazine in the near future, and just focus on my own client work. And then I met the editor-in-chief of Alchemy, Josh Elias, and he's studying the Master of Wine and Master Sommelier programs, and we started sharing a drink and...
Another drink.
And then I'd also started... he introduced me to a friend of his, James Morgan, who's a photographer specializing in food and wine photography. Mm. So I was at home one night, and Josh was over in the UK, I think, for a course, and it occurred to me that there wasn't a publication that I personally wanted to purchase in the wine / extended beverage industry that really captured everything that I wanted to learn. There's definitely a lot of publications, but there's none like the food industry. There's no, Gather Version or Gourmand or Kinfolk or any of those cultural ones. So it just seemed to me that there was a real hole.
So as a kickoff, Australian base to start, or if you go into Sutaya in Tokyo and many other great places, is it global distribution already?
Yeah, got global distribution. So at the moment we've got targeted distribution across Australia, news agents and specialty stores, and then we're sending copies to the main markets: Hong Kong, UK, Japan, Singapore. Mm. Yeah, I mean the Asian market's huge for wine.
Well, it's a very, very handsome title, and it's, as we've already seen, Kinfolk magazine, has managed to do a Japanese edition, almost in record time. And, as you mentioned, whether it's the Japanese market, which is maybe it's a little bit more mature when it comes to, of course, its wine sector, but, whether there could be a Mandarin edition or something else, I could definitely see it happening. Very, very handsome title. Gentlemen, I wanted to maybe just rewind to Thursday's program. We had the publisher of Text joined us, and we were talking about the book market, and the book market, of course, is having its ups and downs all over the world. And Jonathan, just at the start of the program, we were talking about the position of newsweeklies, maybe the challenges that they have here. And yet, when I look at this market, we look at the sales of our magazine in Australia. It doesn't stop. I mean, I remember going back to the wallpaper days. It was always a good market for us. It ranks as our number 3 market for us. And Australians are happy to pay $20+ for that air freight edition. For listeners who haven't spent time down here, is it the combination of lovely weekends, time on the beach, on your terrace, that makes this a great market for magazines? Or maybe as domestic players, maybe you don't feel the same things that we feel. But Jonathan, start with you.
I'm not sure what it is. I guess in Australia, we've always had a weekend newspaper reading culture. That was always the thing that the magazine I wrote for, the weekend magazine for the Sydney Morning Herald, Good Weekend. It was a joy to go out on a Saturday morning and see everybody sitting there in the coffee shops reading it. That hasn't happened so much of late. I think those weekend magazines have gone down market. Mm. They're more celebrity focused. They're cutting costs. They're looking shabby, the paper stock is poor, and all of a sudden you get titles like Frankie and Alchemy and new really quality titles coming up, and people just want them because they are just so handsome. It's a piece of art. You want it on your coffee table. I mean, but then there's good reading in there as well. So I think they're just taking over from that weekend magazine culture to some degree.
Does it surprise you, Jonathan, that people at Fairfax and elsewhere never got that particular memo? I was always amazed when you looked at, you know, Newsweek, and of course there's still a print version of Newsweek around in Europe. I'm not quite sure what it does, but it's so flimsy. You feel there's no sense of value when you pick it up. And as you say, you know, you've got Smith Journal down here, you've got, you know, Frankie, robust, confident titles. Now, of course, there's costs associated with it. They're not weeklies either. But, you know, what do you think has happened?
Well, it happened very fast. I was talking to somebody about this the other day. The woman I consider the best editor in this country just about was my editor at Good Weekend in 10 years ago, Fenella Souter. And in 2004, I think it was, the magazine made $1 million a week in advertising. It was phenomenal. We breached the $50 million a year mark, and that was its high point.
Yeah.
So it actually peaked at that point in 2004, and then the slide was terribly quick, but it had... The magazine, the Weekend magazine, had a literary quality. It was edited for literary quality. It was on beautiful stock. It was big. It was thick. Yes, there was lifestyle stuff in there, but even that was done very tastefully, you know, and in depth, with some level of expertise rather than just frippery. Mm. And then it just, at the top, people decided that those kind of magazines, based on experiences overseas, a few overseas editors came in, that those sort of magazines should appeal to women. And all of a sudden we had a directive that we needed to appeal to women. Mm. And what that meant was, in practice, for right or wrong, that they took it down market and it became celebrity focused.
Yeah.
We even had a mythical woman, Catherine somebody her name was, coming out of the focus groups, who was 37, had two children or one child, you know, had a lifestyle, and that was the person we were writing for. And all of a sudden, of course, the whole thing just collapsed very quickly.
And here we are. Nicholas, how do you regard the state of the newsstand in this country?
Well, I think it's an interesting backlash at the moment. My experience of it, apart from reading the news, is much more on the magazine side of things. But I think for some reason the focus started being where print was trying to compete with the online world, where everything is so quick and updated and very flippant. And something like a printed publication shouldn't be thrown out within 10 minutes. And I think particularly within Australia, for some reason, people want to buy something and hang on to it and put it on their shelf. And I think it's just a backlash on that.
Mm. And you got distracted there for a second.
Did,
You saw the arrival of banana bread, which, you know, of course, this being a Saturday program, you know, absolutely central. And this, you know, I think there's actually a whole magazine to be done on banana bread, because it is such a peculiar Australian thing, which has yet to travel, but it's ready to go. I mean, I think it sort of, you know, reached various pockets, of course, you know, Aussie and Kiwi cafes around the world. But I digress. When you look at what's happened, I guess a little bit up and around the coast, you see what Frankie's done, Smith Journal. I mean, you know, these are titles which have had a global impact. And if I sort of look back, probably the last time that happened, it was when, you could say, certainly on the glossy side, when you know, the rise of Vogue Living and Vogue Entertaining, when they really defined an Australian lifestyle, and people are like, "Wow, it's incredible what happens in this country." You know, is it really like that? Is it really better than California? And yet, in an interesting way as well, that, you know, those titles, you know, whether it's sort of that Byron Bay, you know, make it yourself sort of movement that they've managed to capture. Do you think that those titles and certainly what you're doing as well have been just born out of a reaction to, you know, the three or four big players in this country? And maybe, Jonathan, as you're saying, I mean, God, heavens forbid, you know, that you have to edit by focus group.
Mm-hmm. Focus group's an ugly word.
Very, very,
very ugly.
I mean, I would love to hear sort of the profile of what your you know, sort of the archetype reader of Alchemy would be. We could sort of concoct him over the course of the program. But you know, do you think it is a reaction to those big players in this market?
Yeah, I think definitely. The quality in print journalism, not just within Australia but across the world, for some reason has just dropped significantly. Apart from these independent publications, which, you know, with their low overheads and their targeted distribution and small print runs, you know, it's much more emphasis on getting the content right rather than rushing it out and just trying to sell ads and then stepping back and doing the next one.
We're going to dive a little bit deeper into the state of all things print and news related here in Australia. You're listening to a very special edition of The Stack here on Monocle 24. Of course, you're hearing the trams rumbling around in the background. We're in Melbourne and we'll be back after this.
The ancient practice of agriculture meets modern metropolis as we explore groundbreaking urban farms in Tokyo, Brooklyn, and Oslo. Monocle Films visits the people bringing green growth to their thriving cities.
Everywhere you look, something is growing. There's Japanese pumpkin and bitter melon dangling from trellises, and eggplant sprouting in the lobby. Tomatoes hang from a conference room ceiling, and papaya and passion fruit trees double as partitions for meeting areas.
Seeds in the City, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24. My guests today are Jonathan Van Tiegelen, the editor of The Monthly, and also Nicholas Carey, who is the man behind and co-founder of Alchemy, a new title which is just hitting newsstands around the world. A little bit earlier we were talking about the state of course, the more creative and certainly startup side of the market, and it's no secret that print publications are having a little bit of a tough time in Australia, with more people getting their content online and, of course, dwindling advertising dollars as well. Sales of audited magazines, for example, fell by around 50,000 in the 6 months to June, but an increasing number of smaller niche titles aimed at a more narrow audience, of course, are providing for a more resilient state of the market. We talked about Smith Journal a little bit earlier, and here's a little bit more on that title.
Just over 2 years ago, the creators of Frankie were looking at what was on the shelves for men, and it was a pretty poor offering. They'd also noticed that their friends, husbands, partners had stopped picking up magazines. They weren't reading them. They were reading a lot of stuff online, they were reading books, but no mags, so they saw a gap. And Smith was created, in a sense, to speak to those readers.
What's the magazine's philosophy?
Our philosophy was really to pick up those stories that I think get lost between the cracks between online and maybe mainstream printed press, and give them the attention and time that they deserve and showcase them in a really kind of more in-depth, beautiful way.
Let's take this edition, for example, volume 8. Mm-hmm. So it's got a picture of a very bland-looking, typically Australian suburban house on the front with a completely manicured lawn. What does this volume say?
This is probably a classic Smith story, in the sense that it takes something you see every day, like the suburban Aussie red brick home, something you grew up with, something maybe you have slightly nostalgic feelings towards, but once you delve kind of slightly into its history, it becomes really special and it changes the way that you think about it.
One of the more striking articles in this volume 8 is one about exclamation marks, or reinventing the exclamation marks. Can you tell me a bit about how the story idea was conceived and how you executed it?
Sure. That was a bit of genius from my associate editor, Rick Bannister. He'd been thinking a lot about punctuation, something obviously making a mag we're constantly talking about. So he came up with the idea of maybe asking a few notable writers to invent a piece of punctuation. So John Ronson, Peter Carey, Judd Apatow, and then Stephen Bannum, who's a typographer in Melbourne, designed pieces of punctuation that these guys had come up with.
And what do they mean?
Well, it really depended on the idea from the writer. So, for example, Peter Carey, he sent us an idea that was called A Moment, and it's for a piece of punctuation that happens when you are trying to think of... this is an example of it, when you lose your train of thought. So...
Smith Journal is involved with filmmaking as well.
Yeah, we decided at around issue 4 that we'd like to make a couple of short films to bring to life, I guess, stories that had more of a practical aspect, the kind of stories that you really want to see in motion. Our most recent film is called Bottled History, and it tells a tale and kind of shows, I guess, the process of an older guy, Ray Gascoigne, who kind of grew up on ships his whole life and now makes ships in bottles. He's pretty old, he's in his 70s.
I was born on the Lane Cove River in Sydney and I was at a boat. The first ship I was in, we had a fella there putting the ship in a bottle, and I thought, gee, that's a good little hobby.
Bottled ships sounds like kind of a quaint thing that your granddad would do, and in a way it is, but Ray's ships are absolutely incredible. Visually, there's so much effort put into them and the process is so intricate that we really thought we wanted to lift that off the page.
I just love the shape of them, the sheer, how they swing up high at front end or the forward end, the way they're cut away around the stern, called a counter stern. They're a beautiful thing to look at.
And it was a real privilege to see it done. I'd, you know, personally never come across anything quite like this, and you know, we were all pretty proud to have his story in the mag and also as a film. Another video we worked on was about building a smokehouse. So we had this idea, we wanted to build a like log cabin smokehouse. So we spoke to a guy that we knew in regional Victoria who's a kind of fisher, hunter, maker. His name's Rowan Anderson. So we together kind of embarked on this project.
I think I felled around about 50 pine trees for the build, but the challenge was the backbreaking work of being on the draw knife and peeling the bark off the logs to extend their life. But that was quite a daunting task, and I think if anyone was going to build a log cabin or a log cabin smokehouse, try and con your friends in to come help you peel the logs.
What sort of feedback do you get for a story like this, or for Ray, the tiny shipbuilder's story?
It was so positive. I mean, Rowan's story is really inspiring in the sense that he had no idea how to build this thing. He taught himself. I think a lot of the reaction was, okay, I could do that too. This is amazing. With Ray, I think it was just an overwhelming kind of positive, almost gratefulness that his story was being told and people like him exist. There's a scene towards the end when he kind of finishes a ship in the bottle and he says, oh, it gives me a good feeling.
Probably like an artist would when he's finished a painting, you know.
And a lot of people went crazy for that, because what Ray's obviously doing is just as good, if not better, but he's so humble.
On Smith's website, you describe your magazine. You say that, like our readers, we're not particularly obsessed with being the coolest, the biggest, or the first in line, but we're interested in making things that last. How many more volumes do you think Smith has in it?
Well, it has as many volumes in it as possible, as long as we have good ideas. I guess that's the thing. What we're not interested is making something that already exists. So we need to keep it fresh, and we need to keep having these weird ideas, if be they the punctuation feature or celebrating the suburban red brick house. If we can keep doing that, it'll go for a long time.
And that was our Claire Aird, who sat down with Nadia Sicardo, Smith Journal's editor. You are listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Gentlemen, Jonathan, I wanted to do maybe a trip sort of down to the newsagent. I'm always surprised by just the breadth of the offer. If you go into the right neighbourhood in Australian cities, that it's incredible the uptake, not just domestic titles, but also, one would say, almost very average newsstands. The amount of other print that they bring in from around the world. As we were going into that package, you know, we're talking about, of course, maybe there are fewer people, you know, buying magazines. They're going to other sources and outlets. But do you see your local newsagent or other newsagents that you might pop into less interesting environments? Or, as we've seen in many European cities, that there's almost been this bounce back, that they know that they have to fight a little bit harder, so they become even, you know, more interesting places for titles.
Tyler, certainly in the newsagents I go to, and the local ones, I come from a small country town, they're very much aware of their kind of population. They're targeting it to the town's population. But those niche publications, you see them everywhere now, and you get a sense, maybe this is a quirky observation, but you get a sense of the kind of market that is out there by looking at our federal election result, where we just had the Senate election and you had tiny little minority parties getting representation. We've now got a senator who represents the Motorist Enthusiast Party. Now, I'm sure there's about probably 50 magazines for that particular demographic. It's big enough to get somebody elected to the Senate, as we now know. The same goes for sports for young people. There's somebody who's a single issue candidate who just wants sports for young people. There's probably quite a number of magazines for him as well.
Mm.
So I think that diversity, that those sort of niche publications are finding a market for sure. Mm. Yeah.
Nicholas, when you go to the newsstand itself, a favorite place that you want to go, and do you see that there's a little bit of a fight back in terms of the person who's operating the newsagent?
Yeah, definitely. I think, they have to. You can buy lottery tickets online. You can do all the other little bits and pieces that sustained newsagents now can be bought and purchased elsewhere. So they have to, without telling them what to do, they have to embrace magazines. And the state of magazines is going to these independent publications, which are targeted, and they have their little niche audiences. They don't try and do 30 different things or 60 different things. They do one thing really well.
Mm. Do you think that I always find Australia fascinating because in one way you've got the luxury of being you've got the luxury of isolation and then being a little bit insulated from any things that happen elsewhere. And I've always thought that, that Australians are able to sort of, pick and choose the best. But oftentimes when the worst infiltrates, it hangs around for a while. It's hard to get it off your shores as well. From a media consumption point of view, and if we sort of start to spin the dial and maybe look at online as well, we had one of the political editors from Crikey on the other day. Interesting how that's become a clear national player and almost a bit of an international brand as well. Is that also shaking up the establishment as well? Do you see other sort of shoots happening in the marketplace that, whether it's television or elsewhere, that also are sort of taking this, maybe peculiarly Aussie sort of niche approach to challenging, the major players?
Well, I'm not sure, Tyler. Uniquely Oz approach, you mean? I mean, Crikey is. There's a certain irreverence to Crikey that it's there in the name, it's there in the approach, it's there in the way they treat their politicians.
Yeah.
Which is why it's so readable, Crikey's got it down pat. They've got a couple of key contributors who do things in a way that nobody else in the press gallery does, in the national sphere does. One is their political correspondent, Bernard Keane, and the other one is their cartoonist, First Dog on the Moon. Mm. Now, they're unique in their views, and they often stand poles apart from the way the other journalists look at at what's going on in Canberra. So that's a very effective way of standing out and making sure that that you appeal to a big audience.
Nick, when you look at the channels as well, the sevens, the tens, the nines, but then also everything that sort of happened with satellite as well, and there's some real peculiarities, I think, to Australian commercial television in particular. But yet, we're sitting on Federation Square, and I can sort of look off to my left shoulder and see the logo for SBS behind me, which I often see that and just wish that Channel 4 in the UK or CBC in Canada, that such an organization existed. So new government, as we're talking about as well, for these types of institutions, do they have a future and real and sort of this a real sort of groundswell of support, particularly at a time when I think many feel that axes will swing yet again towards these types of broadcasters and media outlets.
Well, I definitely hope they have a future. I think the other big players, the seven, nines, and tens, they're going to have some interesting years ahead of them, and I think they're going to look to the SBSs and see what they're doing right and wrong, and hopefully they're going to take on board those things and not just be driven by revenue to, it's a bigger picture than...
Yeah, well, we live in hope. Nick, you've got a few titles in front of you, and I'm most intrigued by the one which is at the top of the pile, and it's something which came to my attention a few weeks ago, and I don't know if you want to talk about that first or anything else before we jump over to Jonathan as well. But
No, definitely. So this is a new publication called Kennedy, which its byline is Biannual Journal of Curiosities, which I think really sets the tone quite well. I haven't had a great flick through yet, admittedly, because I've been so tied up with actually pulling together.
Pulling your own title together.
Yeah, but I still continually, I just stumbled across it and thought it looked really good. And it has a really nice tone, just flicking through it. It's got a really soft narrative.
Yeah, well, I think what's, you know, it has a very handsome, very tactile cover, you know, a linen effect, yep. which then has a lovely varnish over top, and this ecru background with a navy blue frame. But what I think is quite lovely about it, I mean, it's very literary when you look at the cover and you think, oh, what's going to be inside? Is it going to be a little bit like a Paris Review? Because they wear their table of contents on the cover, and so they have a cover strap here. Paula Goldstein, editorial director, interviewed in her home in Dartmouth Park, London. The Bluff of the Big Shops, an eerily relevant essay from 1927 on the ethos of supporting small business. Craig Walzer, writer and bookshop proprietor, interviewed in Oya Santorini, Greece. And this is the amazing thing about Kennedy, is that when you go in to the title and you see names like Chris Kontos and Angelo Pandelidis, and on it goes with many other Greek names as well, you see that the title is actually published out of Athens.
Mm. That was a big surprise.
Yeah,
very British.
And at a remarkable time for the Greek economy, that here is something which indulges, as you're saying, in this, you know, this biannual of curiosities, and it's quite a luxurious read. I mean, as you said, you haven't sort of spent too much time on, but certainly given your background in the graphic side, what appeals to you when you look at the form of it?
They've got a great contrast when you flick through from going through the text-based pages to just nice full-bleed images. The type's all treated really, really classically, but with a nice, you know, personal character to it. It follows a pretty strong formula. You know, it's a type of magazine where you flick through and you automatically want to stop and pause and work out what's going on and what that story's about.
Is it a flick through for you, or is it one to read on?
Read.
First glance.
It's a flick through and then read out the parts. And hopefully, you know, there's always a couple of articles which you know you're going to like. Mm. And then you finish that article and you just casually work your way through to the next one, which you had no idea whether you were going to like it or not, and no idea what it was about. And it leads you through those articles really quite well.
Jonathan, the evolution of the monthly right now, I said at the top of the program, you showed us a new cover, which is maybe a little bit snappier than you've been in the past. And I'm wondering, when you look at something like Kennedy, which is very, very bookish, do you see yourselves potentially moving in that type of direction and becoming a little bit heftier, even maybe more collectible than you are already?
It's a hard one, because the magazine that's succeeding in the market at the moment is Frankie, for all sorts of reasons, but one reason is their covers. They stand out on the stands like no other covers, I think. We can't go down that path. It appeals to a totally different demographic. Ours, we hold on to an older market, but at the same time, we've got to leap out from the shelf. We can't do that by looking too busy. We can't do that by being too calm. So hopefully this is the kind of direction we're going in, where we're quite snappy. There's a couple of good cover lines that draw the person in, and basically behave like an old magazine always used to behave, but with some post online touches, if you like.
And in Australia, for a title like yours, what is the, you know, what would be, let's say, the traditional split between newsstand for you versus subscription?
There's no real tradition with us, I don't think. I think that the Bulletin certainly had more newsagent sales than it did subscribers, whereas we've got, it's two-thirds subscribers, one-third sales.
Mm. We're going to go away just for a very, very short break. You're listening to The Stack. We are on Federation Square in Melbourne, and we're back in a moment.
As our first ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living, begins hitting shelves around the world, so too do our editors take to the road to celebrate the launch of this 408-page survey on how to live well. We're visiting our favourite bookstores and retailers in 15 cities across the globe to meet subscribers, contributors and fans. Join us for a glass of wine, a spot of shopping and a chance to meet the team. To find out where we're headed in September and October, keep an eye on book.monocle.com.
And welcome back to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Coming to you from Melbourne, this week. And I'm joined by Jonathan Van Tiglin and Nicholas Carey, of course, of The Monthly and Alchemy, respectively. One of the titles before we went on air, which I'd never seen, Jonathan, maybe you can set it up for us, but it's the Canary Press. And I always sort of feel that we see a lot of things very early on, but where did you stumble across this?
Well, a mate of mine started illustrating it, and of course he pushed it in my direction. This is only the second issue. It's coming out of Melbourne. It's focusing on short fiction, some very short fiction, 200 words, some much longer, of the 6,000, 7,000 word variety. There's usually a couple of good stories in there from, you know, established overseas American short fiction writers. In this current issue, we've got George Saunders and Jim Shepherd. So it's got some real cred, but then it's also a showcase for local writing talent. And it might just be the way to go. I mean, if The Monthly was thicker, we'd love to run a fiction story, because a fiction story is not something anyone will tweet. It's not something anybody will read online. Again, it's about not competing with the online space. I mean, and I think this magazine's got it looks good, feels good, lots of good illustrations. It's probably a little bit more youthful than we'd be. But it's something that you've got to have in the hand. It's not going to work online. In fact, their website's shocking. But it works.
With all due respect, and I really do mean this in a flattering way, it almost strikes me as a magazine that shouldn't have a website, other than maybe just you can find it at this newsagent, and we will post you a copy if you post us a check first.
Well, exactly, because the whole thing screams artisanal. So yeah. It's a hipster mag. Obviously, it's targeting that market, but it's also targeting people who just love short stories. And they're still out there.
I want to go back to the relationship that the monthly has with the digital world, we'd mentioned Crikey earlier, and it's certainly its place within the political landscape in this country. What have you done, and what are you not doing? Which I always think is an interesting question when people sort of grapple with what do they want to give away for free, and what do they want, of course, to get PR'd.
Well, we're starting a paywall very soon, next month.
Something you wish you would have started earlier, or it's just...
Oh, not necessarily, no. We're very much early players in the online world, and we're just trying to figure it out still. We're still trying to figure out what to unlock, for how long to unlock it.
I don't think anyone has that answer, so...
No, that's right. It's very complicated. And then for no reason at all, you get these massive spikes in traffic for one or two articles that you could not foresee. So we're trying to decipher that, but we can't. We can't figure it out. The only thing I know is that our online guy who's running the online side of things is he's an absolute tech whiz, 23. I had dinner with him the other night, and I said, "So, seriously, is there a future for print?" And he just looks at me straight and says, "John, no one gives a shit about the distribution method." I thought, really? That really hurts. But I think he's right in the mainstream, which is where we're going, but at the same time we can hold on to that niche market that still loves us for what we always are and always will be. So I think he's also wrong to some degree, as
many 23 year olds are.
That's right. Yeah, he's very definite about that. But I think I almost compare it to something like slide film. The slide film is still a better product than digital. It'll always will be. Digital can only hope to approximate the best possible slide reproduction. We're talking positives, transparencies.
Sure.
And I think online will also be like that. So if people actually want the best straight away in their hand, they're going to have to either shoot with slide film, which you can hardly do anymore, or you're going to have to read print.
I'm going to Jeremy Leslie's magazine conference in a few weeks, and I actually want to just submit a bunch of Kodak boxes with my slide carousels in them, because it wasn't that long ago that you would go and do presentations and you would have your carousels and your transparency sheets and off you'd go. And
10 years in my case.
Yeah, I mean I think I was even doing it maybe 8 years ago, but it's a remarkable transformation. But what about the daily metabolism that The Monthly has to have? Do you feel that you need to be sort of in the daily minute by minute game as well to be relevant right now, just given the topics that you're talking about?
Ideally, we would be, and we've just started since I spoke to you. I think we have tried to do a little bit of that by getting bloggers in to make it a more lively website. I mean, a monthly website is obviously not going to have a lot of kick in it if it's just based on the monthly publication. So we are trying to do that, but we're not thinking daily. We're really trying to space traffic across the month, and using it in that regard. But we're not going all out. You know, it's not a be it or end all for us to succeed online to that degree.
And Nick, what about for you? Because this is, you know, you could argue that this could, you know, Alchemy could be a wonderful showcase display window for an incredibly powerful, you know, online side, just given sort of the resource of talking about whether it's wines, whether it's sakes, you know, anything within sort of the booze sphere. How do you see it? And is there, because I haven't looked yet, you know, is there a muscular website behind this yet?
Yes, there is. So that should be online in the next couple of days, which is quite exciting.
Which means the next few months.
Hopefully the next few days.
Okay, we'll revisit that.
We'll wait and see. So that's as I was saying earlier, it's a we want to work out the way the print and the online world work together. So our magazine doesn't focus on any new trends or the latest things. You know, the one restaurant that we talked to, a restaurant owner here in Melbourne in South Yarra, and he's been open for 26 years, Francois. And that's about as new as, you know,
right,
we want to get. And that's the beauty of print, that you can go back and you can really sink your teeth into it, like the slow journalism movement, I suppose.
But also, when I look at the title, though, it's very collectible. It's not something you would want to bin if you were moving flat,
so.
That's for sure. And it strikes me to be very hard to... And that it would need, a very defined life digitally, because I think it's very hard to replicate so much of what I see here. And obviously there's been incredible attention and care given to the commissioning photography, the approach to the grid when I look inside, and, you know, not to mention the paper stock as well.
Yeah. Well, it needs to completely stand apart. So the content that we are going to have online, which we will, it's not designed to compete with the magazine. It's a website that gets updated and gets changed and gets, you know, archived in the depths of Google. So it's much more shorter content. It's event-based stuff. We'll be doing a lot of events through the magazine, a lot of wine tasting and gin tastings and stuff. So it's to harmonise the shorter lifespan of the topic, I suppose.
I'm happy to say that, Lisa, it's good that we have some substantial titles around this particular edition of The Stack, as it's rather windy on a late winter Saturday here in Melbourne where we are. Nick, what do you want to look at next? Because you've got a couple of other titles which were probably vaguely inspirational or will certainly occupy the same area where you'll be sitting on the newsstand as well.
Yeah, they definitely occupy the same shelf space. But in terms of the content and look and feel, they're probably... they don't go as in depth into the articles and topics as we're aiming to. It's a lot more picture based. But these titles are the Gourmand, Gather, Journal, and Full. Which
choose one first.
Choose one. All right, we'll go with Full, because it's only got it a couple of days ago, and once again I haven't actually looked through it properly. So that seems to...
Is this because these are going to be savored for reading after the program? When we talked about the Full. On the program a couple of weeks ago, as well. But again, you know, here's another title which, of course, is indulging in the world of all things culinary, food and drink, but it's a curious mix, because when we were looking at it, and I'd love your impression, because, you know, here you have a cover which I think, as one of our guests said, it feels, and here you have sort of a bearded gentleman, nice eyewear, but you could put any number of cover lines on that, and it could be a film magazine, it could be a music magazine, it could be some sort of, you know, more popular culture title, but here it is focusing on food.
Yeah, I think their cover choices are really interesting. I might be wrong, but I think they're all black and white so far. This is the third edition, the newest one. But I mean, in terms of standing out on the shelf, when you're amongst Gourmet Traveller and all the other, you know, food generic magazines, that's gonna... You may not be 100% sure what it's about, but it's gonna stand out, black and white, and just a big portrait of somebody. So hopefully it does. I'm not 100% sure, but, you know, there's always room for a black and white amongst the peacocks.
Jonathan, do you have a confederation of other magazines, or maybe a sort of a sense of safety in numbers? That the Monthly is one title that you would see on many a coffee table, and then, you know, sort of two or three others that you pair up with in terms of distribution, yeah. And trying to think. And I don't want to go back to that focus group lady from The Good Weekend. But certainly it's sort of some kind of mindset that you feel would sort of lend itself to slightly parallel titles.
I guess so. The one classic one is our stablemate quarterly essay, which comes out every 3 months. That's a 25,000 word essay, non-fiction essay with correspondence in it as well. Usually very sharp, very political, agenda setting, that kind of thing. Mm. That is definitely one that we like to be seen next to. The other magazines are probably the old literary magazines. They're suffering, but I brought one along from a long time ago, so don't judge the cover. But Meanjin magazine is one.
I'm not familiar with it, so tell us a little bit about it.
It's probably Australia's oldest literary magazine. Came out of Melbourne University, had some fantastic editors over time. It's now fallen on hard times. They're debating whether to go online only or not because it's not making any money, and its subscribers are probably dying in droves because it is so old. But it remains a good magazine. It remains the best showcase of short literary writing in the country, I think. With the possible exception of ours, but they are very, very good. And for example, this issue that I brought along is the music issue from 13 years ago. We were looking for a music writer. It's very hard in this country, but I think in all countries, to find people who can actually write about music in a way that is not fatuous. And so I went to that looking for a music writer. Didn't find one, but it's that kind of magazine. It's quite authoritative in this country. I think remains so.
I want to ask both of you, and I'll start with you, Jonathan. Here you have a nation, G20 player. Of course, Brisbane will be a G20 host next year, around this time next year, or at least close by. Are you surprised that Australian titles, even media in general, that they don't want to play a bigger role within Asia and Southeast Asia? Because you've seen other English language media brands, and whether it's television, radio, print, etc., some have become very successful, of course, tapping into the Asian market. And yet you're sitting on Asia's doorstep. And of course, there are so many flashpoints. Australia, both militarily and from a foreign policy perspective, they're sort of the super cop in the neighborhood here. So just to both of you, do you think that the monthly should be very prominent on Singapore newsstands and KL? And
I'd love to do it, Tyler. The problem that you face with doing that sort of thing is advertising. It really becomes a problem getting advertisers here interested in us publishing articles that are of interest to Asia. And it's the old model, but we're still stuck with it, unfortunately. But you're absolutely right. It's an opportunity that's there. You're seeing The Guardian doing it here, of course. I mean, it's when you asked before about is it worth our while doing daily things online? No, especially not now that The Guardian's here. We're standing well away. There's lots of opportunities in Asia, I'm sure.
Nick, you talked about, of course, the power of China. Well, not even just China, but, probably looking at a number of Asian markets and their wine consumption habits, the Koreans as well, etc. Is that almost the first stopping point for you in terms of expansion? Yes, it'd be very easy as English language to make your big play in the States if you wanted to. I mean, the U.S. West Coast isn't that far. Well, everything's far from here. But how do you regard sort of the immediate neighborhood?
Yeah, well, our plans, I suppose, is to obviously we need to get Australia right. And then beyond that, we've got New Zealand being such a close neighbour and also huge wine businesses over there. But then Hong Kong is our first target. We really want to get that right and start, doing tastings over there and dinners. And, the magazine for us is just a vanguard to all these other opportunities. Hong Kong and Singapore and mainland China as well. It's lots of exciting times.
We're going to take a very short break, actually almost at the end of the program here in Melbourne, but I want to talk a little bit about business models when we come back to the special edition of The Stack here in Melbourne.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monaco 24. This is Monaco 24. London, New York. Tokyo, London, New York. This Monocle 24.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24 in an increasingly blustery Federation Square here in the heart of Melbourne. My guests today are Jonathan Van Tichelen and Nicholas Carey. Before we go, I wanted to talk a little bit about business models. And before we went to the break, you know, you touched on this idea, of course, you know, tastings and dinners, Nicholas. Do you see that the event side of this, and I'm not sure how advanced your business model is, but is that, you know, probably going to be a big play for you in terms of course, getting people to sample the brand, but also a way of getting the brands, you know, be they beers, you know, or you know, a very fine Pinot Noir in front of your readership?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the advertising model, how we see it, we have to offer them more than just, you know, a single page or double page ad. If we can give them this extended collateral of being involved in events and to different audiences around the world, then it's just, it's going to give them much more incentive to actually put some trust in us and back us.
And have you sort of figured out, is that 25% of the revenue pie, or is it, you know, is it 5%, or is it half of what you do?
We don't have a pie yet.
That's fine. We're not really sure. You can sort of bake it after a year if you want to.
Exactly. But, yeah. No, we're not sure how far this could take off at the moment. Obviously, the world of drinking and being a cultural magazine behind drinking, it's quite huge. We just don't want to lose control, I suppose.
No, of course. And Jonathan, you're also with The Monthly. Whether it's events, whether it's trying to reach people, you know, digitally. That sense of engagement, because you talked a little bit before we went to the break about, you know, a desire, wouldn't it be great to do, you know, broaden The Monthly out into Asia. There's always that discussion with the media agency or with the brand directly, hopefully, about, you know, who your reader is, knowing who they are. And I'm wondering, is face-to-face important in terms of maintaining those relationships? And of course, how do you... I want to sort of say community, because maybe it's a bit of an overused, you know, term when it comes to titles. But as you know, you were saying yourself earlier, you've got that sort of core who've been with you for a long time.
Yeah, and that core is very much urban based, of course. That's something we really need to counter. Well, not counter, but we just need to expand on it. I mean, Queensland is untouched for us almost, except for expatriate New South Welshmen and Victorians. So we really need to increase our presence in places like that. We were joking about that today, about having next winter The Monthly goes troppo for a month,
and we go to Noosa or somewhere.
No, further than that.
Darwin.
Right up the Cape York, right up the top.
Right,
yeah. Darwin. Why not? And
I was going to say the territory probably, you know, they would love to promote it. I mean, there's lots of ad pages. I mean, as long as, of course,
didn't meddle
with your editorial line.
Well, that's right. But as we were joking about it, we became half serious about it. Mm. So it might be something we'll explore. We realised we weren't drunk, and it still made sense. So
I'm sure lots of people listening would love to sort of, you know, visit, you know, Northern Territories or anywhere else. I want to say thank you to Jonathan Van Tichelen, editor of The Monthly, and Nicholas Carey, one half of the duo. One quarter. Okay.
Yes.
Well. Okay. So at least the pies in four parts of Alchemy Magazine, which of course is just out on newsstands around the world. Our producers here in Melbourne today have been Phil Hahn, David Pleasant back in London, and our studio manager is Jack Phillips. If you have any comments or queries for the program, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. Remember, we're back at base next Saturday in London, so do join us then. Of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com or iTunes, but for now, for me, Tyler Blay in Melbourne, goodbye.